is part three of the lectures titled The Anabaptist, The Junk Drawer of the Reformation. The first two were given at a conference down in Birmingham at Dominion Baptist Church. This one is more of a podcast style, a little less formal, a little bit more free-flowing, but I wanted to record it to kind of fill in some of the gaps of stuff I had to skip over too quickly or things that I wanted to say but just didn't have time to say. And I figured this would kind of be the best way to do that without, I mean, obviously I'm not going to get another chance to give three straight lectures on the Anabaptist, but I think this is worth doing because there is interest. There's a lot of questions people seem to be interested in, and there's so much confusion around this group that I think they are worthy of giving a little bit more detail to. So let me get into it a little bit. I wanted to address the question of the argument of what they were then versus what they are now. And I used that title, The Junk Drawer of the Reformation, to show how they were this group where everybody just threw in, lumped everybody in there that was anti-establishment, everybody that was anti-Paedo-Baptist, essentially. And that is not necessarily what they are now. They're not so broad now. What they have now become are pietistic modern-day monks of sorts. And I want to bring that out a little bit more because that trajectory of becoming modern-day pietistic monks was set very early on in the 1520s and 30s by it becoming a holiness movement amongst the portion of the Anabaptists that survived. So a bunch of the Anabaptists didn't survive. They got killed off or died off naturally. Not necessarily like physically died off, but I mean their theology and practice pretty much died off. The millenarians, the radical anti-establishment types, the violent types, the doomsdayers, that type sort of got either killed off or just did not survive because they were doomed to not survive theologically. Those types are just pretty nutty and don't really last. So that broad definition I gave of the junk drawer of the Reformation, and I gave that very long definition saying they were these all the miscellaneous sects, radicals, revolutionaries, mystics, spiritualists, apocalyptic preachers, and lunatics that cropped up in Europe during the confusion that naturally emerged from the rigid and stratified religious socio-economic world that had been turned upside down by the combined forces of the Reformation and the Renaissance. That very long definition, that is what they were then. That's what they were considered. It wasn't necessarily always fair. Some of them, I don't think, were even technically Anabaptist in the sense that they were against Roman Catholic baptism, but not necessarily infant baptism. They were catabaptists. That's a different category than Anabaptist, but we just don't have enough detail. I think that there was a very rare breed. There weren't a ton of catabaptists, but I think some of them were just anti-clerical, anti-Roman Catholic, anti-establishment, and they got lumped in with these Anabaptists. But Anabaptists themselves, the formal ones, were the ones that were technically against infant baptism. So what happened was they became a holiness movement, and I want to fill in a little bit of the details on how that came to be by their lack of articulating justification clearly, and also from Michael Sattler. He seemed to be a big part of it. Michael Sattler's influence, who, again, I talked about him in the very first lecture, his martyrdom, the mystery around maybe his beliefs, the specifics of his doctrine aren't super clear. He seemed to abandon the Roman Catholic monastic ideas quickly after he studied the Pauline epistles. We know that. He left his monastery. He was married very soon after that, and he went to Zurich along with other Anabaptists to join the Swiss Brethren. He was expelled from there fairly quickly after he arrived because they were sort of starting to clamp down on the Anabaptists, and he went to Strasbourg, which is a Reformed city, a Protestant city, and he was received into the home of the reformer Wolfgang Capito, or Capito. I'm not even sure how his name is pronounced. He's not a very well-known guy. But Martin Bucer was also there. So he goes there, and he's received into the home of these guys. And we do know that once he left there, he was commended by both of those men. Both of those men wrote from Strasbourg commending Michael Sadler. So that was a positive for him. He did seem, Sadler did seem to most closely align with the Zurich Swiss Brethren, which again is good because those Zurich Swiss Brethren were in the process of reforming. They were with Zwingli, they were reforming right along. We can assume, more than anybody, we can assume that they had a orthodox view of justification. Justification by faith alone was part of the reform in Zurich. So the fact that he aligned with them is, it gives us hope that Sattler was on board with that, that he aligned with justification by faith alone, because that was a distinctive of them. But then we read things such as, like, from the Global Anabaptist Mennonite Encyclopedia, says that both Sattler and Dank, Hans Dank, questioned the Lutheran doctrine of justification and also held that works were important to man's salvation, which again just raises a ton of questions. What does that mean? Works are important to man's salvation. In what sense? Who's denying that works are important to man's salvation? Nobody. But what role do they play? Are they important in getting men saved, or are they important in showing that men are saved? That's a huge distinction. And the fact that they question the Lutheran doctrine of justification, if that's accurate, if the Global Anabaptist Mennonite Encyclopedia is right in that, that's not a good sign, because the Lutherans got the doctrine of justification by faith alone right at the Reformation. So the fact that they're questioning it, that raises more questions than it answers. Why did they say that? Why were they questioning the doctrine of the Lutheran, or the Lutheran understanding of justification? Did they really do that? And was it on the particulars of the doctrines? And what specifically? We're not super sure, but that means that's important. And I don't know that you're ever going to get the clarity on Sattler's supposed disagreement. We do know that Dank and Sattler had disagreement with each other. They weren't necessarily in agreement on it with everything. And we know that Sattler had disagreements with his discussions with Martin Bucer and Capito, the two reformers in Strasbourg that he was with. They had these discussions. They received him into the home. They had brotherly discussions. So it's possible, even based on what they talked about, it's possible he might have held to a version of limited atonement and even election and predestination, which would be a surprising and an anomaly amongst the Anabaptists. But Sattler might have held to that along with the Swiss Brethren, because the Swiss Brethren probably did. Sattler may have bought into that as well in his alignment. We know that he disagreed some with Dank. And what did he disagree with Dank, though? We just don't know. It does appear that they discussed justification by faith alone in some degree, but the details on that aren't clear. What they discussed, what they agreed with. Now, does Sattler just say, does he just want a greater emphasis on works? What are the details there? We don't know. And I don't know that it's ever going to be found out. So they had these discussions. Bucer and Capito both said the discussions were brotherly discipline and peace. So they didn't necessarily agree, but we don't know what they disagreed on, but it was a brotherly discussion, a respectful discussion. So that's a little bit frustrating, but that's history with the Anabaptists. You're not going to get absolute clarity on this sort of thing, and we have all these questions. So here is what Capito said of Sattler when he commended him after Sattler left and Capito wrote. He says this, and there's a little bit of a long quote, but I think this is very, very helpful. So he said this: "This Michael is known to us here in Strasbourg, and he was somewhat in error, which we showed him through the scriptures, But since he saw a lack in our preachers and other preachers of the true doctrine, especially in the outward life of the congregation, he perhaps paid less attention to our admonition. But at the same time, he showed such great zeal for the honor of God and the Church of Christ, which he would have pure and blameless and without reproach to those who are outside. We never censored this, but praised it highly. But his method and the articles of his faith we always kindly rejected, and that was after mature reflection before God. Now, we did not agree with him herein. He wanted to make pious Christians through a fixed creed and outward compulsion, which we considered the beginning of a new monkery. That is very important. He goes on. But we desired to correct the life of the believers through consideration of God's good deeds, which he has shown us in body and soul, that it might be full a fruit of love and gratitude, for this is the way and the order of salvation. That is massively insightful. He saw in Sattler this pushing of a holiness movement. And he saw in Sattler the reason why he wasn't trusting what they were saying is because he's seeing these, well, not all your people, not all your clergy, not all your people are coming around and leading these holy lives that Christians are to lead. And therefore, he doesn't take what they say with as much importance as he should have. Now, why is he seeing that? Because of sacralism and infant baptism that makes these people Christians by virtue of being part of the state church. But they're not actually Christians in terms of conversion. They're not born again. They're not Christians by conviction necessarily. They're just part of the state church. So let's say a priest is in the Roman Catholic Church and then Reform sweeps through the city, and a lot of these guys go along with Reform, and this priest doesn't really care. He's not born again. He's not really a Christian. He's just there as a political office. He goes along with it, goes along to get along. He's not necessarily going to start leading a holy life all of a sudden. He'll go along with these things. So you're not going to find broad sweeping conversions necessarily when these cities change over. Not everybody that was Roman Catholic and now is considered Reformed is suddenly a true born-again believer. And Sattler sees this, and he's like, well, what you're saying in your doctrine must not be true, because look at the fruit it's producing. It's not producing these holy lives, and he would reject it. Well, that's because of sacralism and infant baptism. It's the fact that they're considered Christians when they're not really Christians. So I think what he's seeing in that lack of holiness, we can root in the error of sacralism and infant baptism. But the fact that Capito saw that he wanted to make pious Christians through a fixed creed and outward compulsion, and they considered that a new monkery, that is what Anabaptists became. That is the beginning of, this is a holiness movement. We need holiness in the church, and we don't care about the doctrine, we care about the obedience to law. So they push law. And Capito says, we want to do it through consideration of God's good deeds, which he has shown us in body and soul, that it might be a fruit of love and gratitude, for that is the way and the order of salvation. He's saying, we convert people with the gospel. Sattler wants to convert them with the law. But the Reformed recognize you don't convert with the law. The law tells you how to live. It's important. But the gospel does the converting. That is the means God uses. The Holy Spirit converts through the hearing of the gospel. This is a massive, important thing. Anabaptists go to law, Reformed went to gospel. The Anabaptists don't understand that distinction between law and gospel, and so they institute a new monkery. That is, they became the pietist new monks. That's what we see in the Anabaptists. They invented a new monkery. When you look at the Old Order Mennonites, the one with the true Anabaptist identity, the Old Order Mennonites, the Amish, the super conservative, traditionalist, I don't want to say conservative because that's not accurate, traditionalism, the Hutterites, those are the ones with the true Anabaptist identity, and they're living as new monks, pietists. So I think Capito saw Sattler's Error right, and I think Sattler's Error set in motion the trajectory. He set the trajectory for the future of the Anabaptists as a holiness movement and becoming that new monkery. But then we also have this commendation from Bucer. He said, "We do not doubt that Michael Sattler, who was burned at Rotterburg, was a dear friend of God, although he was a leader of the Anabaptists, but much more skilled and honorable than some." So Bucer rightly sees, like, some of these Anabaptists are nuts, some of them are honorable men, and Sattler was a dear friend of God. So that gives me hope, again, right there, to be optimistic about Sattler. That he was a friend of God. He was confused on some things. He didn't understand law and gospel. He got his methodology wrong for creating Reformation. The reformers want to reform the church by getting the doctrine right, and therefore the people will then be converted and they'll start leading lives of holiness. Sattler is more, and the Anabaptists as a holiness movement are more, force the law, give them law, but they get that wrong. They're blatantly wrong there because law does not convert. And this is why I say they missed the boat on the Reformation. The distinction between law and gospel, the understanding of those roles, is a huge part of the Reformation. And the Anabaptists basically took the Roman Catholic position. Most of them didn't abandon the Roman Catholic idea of synergism and the way that grace is essentially earned through obedience. The Roman Catholics used the sacramental system to get that grace. The Anabaptists used their new monkery, what Capito called a new monkery, and he's right. He's right on that. So hopefully Sattler just had a methodological error here on law and gospel, and it's not that he actually disagreed on justification by faith alone. We don't know that for sure, but we hope, based on Bucer's words, calling a friend of God, that that is the case. I don't think that stayed the case for Anabaptists going into the future. I think Sattler set it in motion as a holiness movement. Menno Simons absolutely furthered that, but I don't think they stayed as orthodox on justification by faith alone. They are rejecting the Reformed doctrine of justification by faith alone overall, as a tradition that's, I mean, obviously not every single one, but as a tradition, that's generally what happened. I think that the Anabaptists got deeper and deeper mired in error as that tradition grew. And maybe if Sattler had been able to stick around and the Swiss Brethren had been able to stick around, definitely if the Swiss Brethren had been able to stick around, they wouldn't have gone so off the rails in terms of doctrine, or at least in failing to define themselves doctrinally. And you know, that's just an awful thing that happened. Sattler killed by Roman Catholics, several of the Swiss Brethren killed by Roman Catholics as well. Some of that fault lies at the hands of the Reformed in the sacralism. They did not reform that for many years, many decades, so that's unfortunate, and they are to blame for that. So nobody is fault-free here. Most of the fault lies with the Roman Catholics, of course. And in those other talks, talking about how radical some of these Anabaptists are, and they got themselves killed, and some of them genuinely deserve to be killed as being really rotten, rotten people. I don't mean to imply that some of them weren't genuinely martyred. They were, but you know, and I gave some examples of some that were genuinely martyred, some that weren't, some that were allowed to live in peace. The fact that Sattler was received in kindness by in Strasbourg, a Reformed city, again reflects that toleration and that willingness to talk as long as you're not too radical of a heretic. But the fact remains, in that day and age, if you are a flat-out heretic, you're going to get yourself killed. If you deny the Trinity, if you're an atheist, if you deny some doctrines that, you know, were wrong, you can get yourself killed. But if you're some of these guys getting killed that were genuine heretics, like, they don't deserve to be killed civilly, but that was the civil rule then. But it doesn't make them good guys. You know, Michael Servetus was a genuine heretic when he was killed by the Genevan City Council. Calvin asked that he not be burned. They rejected Calvin's pleas. Calvin evangelized him all the way to the stake, walked with him, trying to get him to recant. Could not. But the idea was still that heretics were killed back then, and he was a real heretic. But him being killed as a heretic doesn't make him right, doesn't make him not a heretic. I think it's also worthy to note that Philip of Hesse, a ruler in Germany, he was one of the guys that fought against the Peasants' War when they revolted, but he did not allow Anabaptists to be killed. So even Anabaptists say that he showed extraordinary generosity and kindness to them. You'll find them saying that about Philip of Hesse. He saw them as a disorder in religious life, which had its roots in error and weakness in the faith rather than in moral error like sedition and revolt, and which must therefore be treated with leniency and consideration. He's exactly right with that consideration, that some of them were just a disorder religiously. They were wrong. They weak in the faith. They had error. But they weren't all trying to do this sedition and revolt like they got the name from the Munsterites and those that were trying to help the Munsterites or trying to flock to the Munsterites or trying to mimic the Munsterites. Not all of them were that way, but they had this reputation. Philip of Hesse saw through that. So that's another good example. Philip of Hesse didn't want him killed. He also mentioned, and this is important too, that they had improved conduct over some of the Lutherans. Philip of Hesse saw that. Some of these Anabaptists are leading more holy lives than these Lutherans. Why is that? Again, sacralism and infant baptism. These Lutherans weren't Lutherans by conviction. They were Lutherans because their city became Lutheran, because Lutheranism spread in areas, and because they live in those areas, they're considered Lutherans. But they're not convictionally Lutheran. They're not born-again believers. Even if they agree with it, they're not necessarily born again just by saying, I reject the Roman Catholic Church, and yeah, I like the Lutheran one more. So Philip of Hesse saw that, and I think that's accurate. He saw the Anabaptists living more holy lives because people that were Anabaptists by conviction. They're not born into it. That's part of being Anabaptist. You're not born into being an Anabaptist. So that's very important. I think that's worthy of note. Few other things I want to mention regarding Munster. As Munster became, it's this diverse city, and as it had this change coming through it, it's sympathetic towards Lutheranism. It's technically Roman Catholic, overseen by a prince bishop, Roman Catholic prince bishop, and meanwhile, it's becoming radically Anabaptist. And as this change is happening, as the Lutheranism spread and was tolerated and eventually became the dominant thing, and then the Anabaptist spread, from the outside, that was largely seen as Protestant. Whether right or wrong at that point is unclear. Very early on, like Bernard Rothman, who was one of the first guys in there preaching, he's Lutheran, he's reforming, and then he suddenly becomes Anabaptist. He may have been Orthodox very early on, and then only radicalized after the arrival of more and more Anabaptist and seeing this momentum. I don't know where we could get absolute. You would probably have to look at the pamphlets that they were producing and see if you can see a trend towards greater and greater radicalization. That would be difficult work. I don't know if anyone's ever going to take the time to do that. But in response to the movement in Munster, Catholic leaders in December of 1532. So, that's 3 years, I guess about 2 years when it's all added up, two and a half years before the end of the rebellion. But in 1532, they see this Protestant movement that's happening in Munster, soon to be an Anabaptist revolt. But they convened a strategic conference just outside the city. And that was broken up by an armed and angry mob of Munsterites. So, a larger confrontation was narrowly avoided when neutral negotiations broached a compromise, recognizing the divided nature of the city, of the church in the city. So that's really interesting. Even as early as 1532, the prince bishop sees this is going on. They convene this thing, and Munsterites come out and break it up. They got radical pretty quick. So more interesting information. They were willing to take up arms very early on, and it almost got worse before they brought in those neutral negotiations to broach that compromise. So that Munster story, just there's no end to the details and how interesting it is. I don't know that I mentioned this guy's name, but the one eyewitness account that we have is Hermann von Kessenbrock, who was a Roman Catholic historian. Or his parents were booted out of Munster when they kind of cleared the city, and he went back years later and pulled a bunch of records and told eyewitness accounts and retold the story. His account is probably to be taken with a grain of salt. He's very anti-Anabaptist. He's probably going to take the worst stories and include them for sure as true in his retelling. His book is in German because he's German. But it got published in, I think, the 18th century. It is published in English, but it is a Brill publication. If you know anything about publishing, Brill is a very scholarly publishing house and publish things that almost no one reads. So their books are outrageously expensive. I think his is somewhere between 200 and 300, maybe a little over. I saw most of them were over $300. So that's not atypical for Brill publications. But you can see portions of his writing on Google Books. There's some woodcuts that are really interesting from the torture and from some of the Anabaptist guys, Nipperdaling and Rothman, Mathis, Leiden. I think there's some woodcuts in there that you can see. So that's interesting. I would love to get my hands on that Brill publication. I don't know that I'm ever gonna. I seriously doubt it. If you were looking for more information, you might want to look at an article called For the Honor of God and to Fulfill His Will, The Role of Polygamy in Anabaptist Munster. That's by Darren Williamson. If you have access to scholarly articles, you might be able to get that. If you know my email, traver7@yahoo.com, you could email me. I could send it to you. Also, Anthony Arthur wrote a book called The Taylor King, The Rise and Fall of the Anabaptist Kingdom of Munster. And that would also be pretty interesting to you if you're looking into more details of Munster. Like I said, there's just no end to the details on how interesting it is. And I'm sure there's some that are not true, but even if half, like I said, even if half of them are true, it's the craziest story that you're ever going to read in church history. Some more things about that. The polygamy, when it was instituted, Bernard Rothman initially resisted that idea pretty strongly, along with some others, but was eventually convinced, and I say eventually, relatively quickly, but it took some convincing. And it was the prophetic authority of John of Leiden that really got him to believe it. And this got to the point where Rothman was so convinced that he was publishing pamphlets and distributing a theological defense of the practice. And those are still available. We can still read his explanations why polygamy ought to be reinstituted in Munster and why they thought it was okay. Now there are other reasons that are interesting to talk about, like the fact that they basically had a 3-to-1 women to men ratio, and some say, well, they needed to stabilize things socially and things of that nature. There's proposals of why it may have been. There's that explanation I think that Hermann von Kessenbrock gives, that Leiden had been caught sleeping with a maid in Nipperdaling's house, and he was trying to cover his tracks. So that there's a lot more information about the polygamy thing. And I talked about it being sexual chaos, and I don't mean that as in there was rampant sexual perversion or a wild love fest, like these Anabaptists are a bunch of hippies. I mean, they are in a sense, and they aren't in a sense. They were actually quite strict in their sexual moral code, like the other Anabaptists, with the exception of the polygamy. They still had the death penalty for adultery and fornication and stuff like that. So it's not a rampant love fest like it's just sexual chaos in the sense of just perversion, but it is perverted in the sense of the polygamy and the forcing into marriage that happened. Rothman advocated the idea that sex was purely for procreation, which they wanted to increase the population. They wanted more procreation. They had way too many females and they needed more males. They needed to grow. They wanted to, create this Anabaptist uprising in the entire world. Leiden said that he was going to take over the world. He's going to be king of the world eventually. So they're not necessarily doing it out there satisfying their basest desires. I think there's an element of that to it. I think there always is with polygamy. Anytime polygamy has been instituted, there is an element of this is so men can have sex with more women. That's just a reality to it. But some of them actually viewed the polygamy as a way to avoid more sexual sin. Because, look, these people can't control their desires. If we institute polygamy, then some of these needs can be met by, say, some of these women or whatever it may be, and we'll stop more fornication and adultery. Now, that's probably a ridiculous thing to think, but some of them say that that's what they were thinking. It was relationally chaotic, revolving around the realm of sex, but it wasn't sexually chaotic, as in just people out in the streets doing anything and getting away with anything. So they still had the resistors to this decapitated, but so were those that were sinning sexually, adultery, incest, rape, fornication, other unclean sexual sin. There was still the death penalty instituted for that sort of thing. So I wanted to clarify a little bit of the sexual chaos comment on Munster. I want to return a little bit to their idea of justification, imputed righteousness, what they believed, what they didn't. Something interesting can be found in Peter Reidemann, and I'm not even sure how to say his last name either. He's called the second Hutterite, or the second leader or founder of the Hutterites. He actually wrote a confession of sorts, and it's fairly lengthy, surprisingly lengthy. And you can see in his writings something that a common theme of basically an unclear explanation of justification and how it's by faith and works and what they mean by it. Because when you read him, it's shockingly similar. And he's not the only one, but it's shockingly similar to the Roman Catholic idea of infused righteousness. They want to say, oh, these works are important, but the works are not our own. They're done by grace. They're works of Christ in us, but they're still your works that are getting you justified. Well, Roman Catholics basically say the exact same thing. They say, the righteousness of Christ is infused into us, and we become more righteous and do the works of Christ by grace, and only by those works are we justified. And that's really, really close to what the Anabaptists say. When they do say anything, it sounds very, very close to that. And that's different than imputed righteousness that's counted to us, and that righteousness is perfect. It's Christ's righteousness that's perfect, and that gets you justified through faith alone. Now, the righteousness that we do as we are sanctified and made more like Christ, also by faith alone, but as that happens, we do good works, but those are a reflection of the fact we've been born again. That's the Reformed idea. It's very different than the infused righteousness idea. What I found shocking was the similarity of the description of righteousness and how that leads to justification from Roman Catholicism to the Anabaptist. They don't use that formal language and the technicalities that you'll see, but the concept is nearly identical, which again goes back to that point that they didn't really abandon the medieval Roman Catholic ideas of soteriology and how you're saved. That's them becoming a holiness movement. They saw the lives of this supposedly Christian Europe, like Sattler, just like this Peter Reidemann. He says the same thing. They say disgraceful lives in the clergy, and because the clergy was treated as a class or as an occupation, a means of social mobility, and a lot of these priests and monks were rotten to the core, and they saw that. And when Lutheranism or Reform swept through a city, not all of those priests and monks were genuinely converted to the Reformation. So you can see a lack of holiness amongst them. And the Anabaptists saw it, they were sickened by it, and they were determined to become a holiness movement. And I lay that at the feet of sacralism and infant baptism. So their focus became moralism and holiness. And they sought to end that by the law instead of the gospel. And they created this new kind of monkery. They became a holiness movement. That's ultimately what they devolved into after the Swiss Brethren were out of the picture, after Sattler set that in motion. The most doctrinally grounded of the bunch got taken out of the picture all too swiftly. I really think that's the cause. The Anabaptists were seeing a society that was supposedly Christian, and they were seeing these despicable lives and led by people, and they just said, nope, that must be wrong. So they wanted a moral reform. They wanted a pure church. Capito saw that in Sattler. He wanted a pure church. And who doesn't? But the reasons they weren't seeing it were not because the doctrine of the Reformation was wrong. It's because it was new on the scene, and sacralism was still in place. If that doctrine had time, then yes, the gospel would be preached throughout Europe, and people would be converted and join the church by choice, by conviction. You know, that's what we eventually got to. People aren't born into the church. Well, I mean, not so much anymore, depending on where you're at. There's still state churches, but it's different. And this is why I say they missed the boat on the Reformation. This early fundamental misunderstanding of law and gospel set the trajectory for where the Anabaptists would go and what they would become after these radical violent sects were killed off. So that's why they have become what they are today, this new form of monkery. It's kind of a sad thing, but they still have this authoritarian, idiosyncratic set of traditions that they use, this law that they try to force, the authoritarian abuse of authority in the church by the leaders trying to force these things that you see in the Amish, the Old Order, Mennonite, and other groups. The shaming of those that leave to make them question their salvation. There's no salvation outside of this group. They're not outwinning hearts with the gospel. They're not making people obey out of gratitude and thanks for what's been done for them in Christ. They're forcing it by fear of the law. And that is why they missed the boat on the Reformation. That's why they became what they are, what they have become. It's those theological errors that they failed to overcome 500 years ago. So I hope that brings a little bit more clarity. I might keep adding to this. I know it's a bit repetitive, but I want people to see the difference in the Anabaptists, what they were, what they became, the ones that died off, the ones that lived on, some of the very early ones. I genuinely think they could have been a Puritan type movement if they had been given the time to set their feet concretely in the Reformed doctrine and push away from sacralism, away from infant baptism, and get to what the particular Baptist eventually got to 100 years later. They're not the spiritual forefathers of the particular Anabaptist, but they anticipate them in a way. The Swiss Brethren, that is, not the Anabaptists as a whole, just the Swiss Brethren in Zurich. And I will keep it isolated to them because they're the ones that were the most solid doctrinally. When you read these other guys, like, where can you read them explaining justification by faith alone? Where can you read anything that's capable of refuting Roman Catholicism in terms of their soteriology, in terms of the concepts of Roman Catholic soteriology that is wrong? Not just the sacramental system, not just the weird traditions that Roman Catholicism came up with, but the actual heart of Roman Catholicism, the syncretism and the synergism of Roman Catholicism. They don't have writings that are capable of really rejecting it. It's just a demand for holiness, and then all these idiosyncratic authoritarian traditions that they come up with, this the weird stuff that they come up with, like Well, you can read about it in some of the confessions. Read Peter Rydman's confession. You can Google that and that'll come up. And I mean, again, if you want some of these sources, you can email me. And I've got a lot of them saved in a folder as I work through this stuff. I've saved it. And if you want to read some of it, you can email me and I can send some of it on to you. But this growth of Anabaptism in the reformational Europe, where sacralism and infant baptism are still so dominant, this shows how important holiness and separateness from the world are in convincing people that your message of Christ is true. Because if you don't have that, you're just not going to convince nearly as many people. It's just massively important that you personally lead a holy life and are separated from the world when you're delivering the message of Christ, especially when the outside world is so dark. You have to be set apart from them. And the fact that Anabaptism rose like this, and for the reason that it did, shows why that is so important. And that is a lesson that we can take away. A demand for holiness of life and a demand for separateness from the world, so that our message of the gospel is truly considered. It doesn't mean that everybody's going to believe it, but they're not going to be distracted by, like, why am I listening to this guy when he lives this way? Or there's this church, supposedly, in this state that believes this way, and look at the lives that I see amongst these people. Why would I believe that message? You know, it's funny. I worked for Caterpillar, and there was a Muslim guy that I had a conversation with, and he considered America this Christian nation. And he said, "This is Christianity? Look at your nation. Look at your entertainment industry." And I said, and I was with him, and I said, "No, no, 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 no. That is not because they're Christian. We are not a Christian nation in that sense. This isn't a bunch of, like, yeah, you can find polls of people calling themselves Christian, but no, they're not all Christian." And this Muslim was seeing and reacting the way that the Anabaptist looked at Europe and said, "Oh, this is Christianity, huh? Well, I reject that." That's what this Muslim was doing. "Oh, this America, this is what Christianity is? I reject that." And it strikes me as it's the same thing going on, and that's why it's so important that we lead these holy lives that are separate from the world. People look at that and it matters. It will kill your message if we are a church of unholy people that are the same as the world, look the same as the world, act the same as the world, believe the same as the world. It kills the message of the gospel. So there's a lesson to be learned. I might keep adding to this. I might add a fourth, as more things come on. As I think of more things, I just can't stop the reading. It's so interesting. If you get into the sources, it's so hard to stop reading. I wish there was more clarity. There's so much to read, and there's so many people to look at, and there's such a uniqueness to this area of history. But at the same time, you demand. It's so frustrating to read. Like, well, tell me what you think about justification, and you can't get this clarity that you want so bad to have a conclusive explanation of where these guys were. So happy studying, and thanks for listening.